Tonight, we have Steve. We're very excited. Steve's home group is in Princeton. He just airdropped the audio from the Jersey Shore Big Book meeting roundup, so I'm pretty excited to listen to that. He comes as a recommendation from Devin, if you guys remember him from Brooklyn. Yes? Yeah. So welcome. Thank you.
Hi, thanks. Hi, everybody. My name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. As was said, my home group is the Common Solution Group in Princeton, New Jersey. We meet Monday nights from 7:30 to 8:45 p.m. We are a big book step study. We basically have speakers from within an hour come and share their experience, and we read the book line by line, sharing our experience as we go, or in relevant history, or you know, moments of awakening, or whatever in our experience with working these steps. My sobriety date is April 18th of 2014. Now, that is not my first sobriety date. It took me a long time to be able to get to this point, to be able to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, find out what I really suffered from. So I kind of first got sober back in the mid-90s, in 1996. I was failing out of Penn State University. I was drinking and partying every day, doing what 23-year-old kids do at that age, you know. And, big football school, big party town, things like that. I drank to get there. I drank for effect. I drank the way I wanted to get. If something good happened, I would celebrate. If something bad happened, I would drown my sorrows. And then I started to notice people in my life all of a sudden kind of checking off life boxes. You know how those some people can just check off those life boxes, like graduate from college and get married and have kids and pay their bills on time and things like that. I couldn't do any of that. I grew up basically an athlete. I had ambitions of playing professional sports as a living, so I figured I didn't need to worry about all that stuff. Threw all my eggs in one basket and decided, all I have to do is get through college and then I'll, move down to Florida and start pursuing a career in professional golf. But I had a big issue. I could not stop partying. And I remember this horrible gray cloud kind of coming into my life of depression, and I'm going to counseling and doing all this, that, and the other thing. And I go back to school one semester and I find out I'm on academic probation. And if I don't get my my stuff together, that the university is going to disinvite me to attend their college. So I end up going down to this CAP center because I got to find a way to get a medical withdrawal. Because I had all the best intentions of coming back that semester and straightening up my act. And I got back and I found out the roommate I had the semester before had moved out because of my partying. And they had the gall of giving me an Australian exchange student. So, of course, I had to kind of show them what America was all about and, show them around town and all that other stuff. So now there I am again, off and running. And I end up going down to this CAP center because I got to, it's on me now. The heat's on. I'm trying to figure out how am I going to get out of here. And I got to, fake a terminal injury or something. And I go down, and I keep talking about this partying and this depression, and he sees that I'm talking about this, so he says, Steve, we're going to meet next week. And what I want you to do is I want you to try to set a goal for how many times you can drink and use for the rest of the week. And I was like, oh, all right, that's fine. I was like, and so we set the goal, and I was like, well, we got a big game against Michigan this weekend, so it can't, it's going to be a big weekend, so we'll probably go with, let's go with four, right? And I went home that day with the absolute intention of not drinking every day. And something would happen during the evening where I would change my mind. I'll do it tomorrow. And the time came to go back down to the CAP center, and I just remember walking in there kind of devastated because I was a blackout drinker. I didn't know this at the time, but I was starting to black out pretty heavily there. And I remember looking back at the week knowing that Tuesday and Wednesday happened, but I couldn't tell you what I did during those days. Couldn't wake up before noon, so all my classes ended up getting scheduled on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the evenings, and I couldn't even make those. And I go back down to this counselor, and he starts hearing me share my tale of woe, and he goes, Steve, and he starts talking to me about this line of dependency, abuse and dependency, and you don't really, and I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. And I heard what I needed to hear, where he said, Steve, I think you've crossed that line. I'm going to recommend you leave school and go to treatment. And I was like, okay, great. That's when I checked the box. That's what I needed to do. That was my goal. So I'm thinking I managed to do that. And I ended up at this place in Wernersville, Pennsylvania, called the Caron Foundation, which I spent 28 days there. And I'm in there, and they check me out, and I'm watching guys detox withdraw from some pretty heavy drugs. And I'm sitting there going, I think I've overshot the mark here. I think I kind of sent the Marines in here to take care of a shoplifting charge kind of a thing. And I'm watching TV and having blood pressure fluctuations, and I'm watching guys look like amusement parks, just the way they were shaking and vomiting and going through all this other stuff. And I'm like, man, glad I don't have what that guy has. Right? And I go through 28 days of, learning what drugs and alcohol do to my system, learning about my triggers, learning what, none of which was what I actually suffer from, right? And we had speakers come in and share their stories, their drunkologues and things like that. And I heard some, interesting things, and I was just like, wow, man, I'd kind of lock that up and keep that to yourself. That's not something you come in and share with a bunch of strangers, because some of it was like, I would have been embarrassed to share that stuff because that never had happened to me. So now I'm starting to see myself distance. Oh, I don't have that problem. I don't have that problem. Then I start hearing about these things that they're doing, and like, well, I don't think I have what they have, so I don't think I have to do what they do. And, I leave this center after 28 days, and, I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm going to just not drink and go to meetings, and if my ass falls off, I'm going to pick it up and take it to a meeting, and I'm going to go and meet somebody and get a coffee commitment, get a home group, and go to meetings. And that's what I did. And some guy picks me up that's my age now, and we start going to meetings, and I start going to these open discussion meetings where we're talking about our problems and going to the diner afterwards, and I lucked out because I fell in love with the fellowship, the people. I'd never belonged anywhere. I was never invited back, like, hey, we're going to the diner, you want to come? And I was like, wow, I'm actually being invited places, because normally I talk myself out of situations like that because a little too much of me shows up for people to be comfortable with. And something interesting happened over the next 6 months. I started getting sicker and sicker inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, like blind rage, murderous rage stuff. And I'm working a program based on abstinence from alcohol is my problem. And if that's the problem, then just don't drink and go to meetings is one hell of an answer, right? Still not having any idea that what I suffered from. Not that anybody was trying to keep it from me. They didn't know either. And if if anybody's been around for a period of time, and you were around back in the mid-90s, big book meetings, I'd never heard of them. I just was like, here's where we're going. We're going to listen to this guy share his story, and we're going to drink coffee and get all sugared up and have some fun, that kind of stuff. And I was able to kind of white knuckle it. I was staying at home with mom and dad, and where all great success stories start, and nothing changed at home. Like, I'm thinking, wait a minute, guys, we're all supposed to get well. And they just kind of went about their days like, boy, you got some type of problem. And I get back into school. I finally get enough focus where I'm able to graduate, and then I move off to Florida to pursue a career chasing not Walter Hagen but Tiger Woods, and that didn't work out so well. I got down there. I didn't want to be the new guy, so I didn't kind of check in with meetings or get a sponsor. I hadn't really done any step work other than the way we did it back then. It was like you work step 1, 2, and 3 getting here, and then here's where the inventory process is. Go to this page and write out your life story. We're going to sit down and you're going to share it with me. And I didn't get a lot out of it. I'm other than a confessional perspective, like, okay, I got that off my chest kind of a thing, and no other perspective was offered. No depth of understanding to change, to like blow old ideas and resentments up and things like that, which I didn't really understand that I had at the time. Because remember, I'm still like all right, my sponsor guy tells me this is what I have to do, to become one of you guys. So I get my inventory done, and I do this fifth step, and I make a couple of tornado amends, and get patted on the head and say, just keep doing what you're doing kind of a thing. And off I go back into self-reliance. I go down to Florida. I start playing professional golf, and within 2 years, I get a debilitating back injury that ends my career. Now, late 90s, early 2000s, South Florida, back injury, go to a doctor. What do you think happens? Now, I was not a pill guy until I became a pill guy, right? I took these things as prescribed, stopped taking them when I got used to, but I had no idea what I had awakened within me. Right, I took this pill and I was like, oh, you know, it makes me feel a little weird, but I was able to kind of put it down, right? And then, I'd injure my back again, or, you know, because I started teaching golf for a living. I ended up moving to Florida and meeting this really famous teacher. And a lot of these guys that I kind of came up with, I now see on TV today. So I, you know, call them one. I had to go through this process of, like, now I have to go out on tour to help these guys. So I'm getting flown all over the world to teach these guys on TV, and they're making millions of dollars, and they don't want to, you know, they just tell people that you work with me kind of a thing. And I was like, great, I'll tell that to MasterCard. I'm sure they'll just forgive my bill. And it's kind of like how it was for a while. But as I'm going through this process, like all these things, I'm sober now, so in sobriety, right? I'm, you know, just not drinking, going to meetings here and there. I kind of got away from the fellowship because I get to go off and get my cash and prizes now. Now that I've gotten rid of the problem, right? The booze and the drugs and all that stuff. So things got better for a time. As you would think, I graduated from college and, you know, got a little bit of money in the bank, and I'm traveling around and I got the pretty girlfriend and all that good stuff. And I finally arrive on the PGA Tour and LPGA Tour. I'm getting paid to go to Hawaii. I'm going to Canada. I'm going to all these places. And I'm absolutely bankrupt inside. I'm broken. And I've been now it's like 8-some-odd years later. I'm dry. Kind of got away from the meetings. Right now I'm working in the Hamptons during the summertime, in Palm Beach during the wintertime. And I'm like, what's better than this, right? Why do I feel so lousy? Right? I had no idea what I really suffered from, right? Still, right? And I'm still going to meetings here and there. And, I get my back tweaks up. All of a sudden, I'd start stubbing my toe. If one's good, two is better kind of a thing. And at 12 years after me doing the north-south thing, I moved down to Florida. And I'm down there at the absolute height of what I was doing, making the most amount of money, traveling the most I'd ever been. Suddenly the thought crosses my mind to pick up a drink. And no thought of what I learned in rehab, that maybe I'm not being too smart here, it ever popped into my head. This strange mental blank spot that I had no idea what they were talking about in the book when I read it at rehab. They gave me this book and they said, here, read some of the stories in the back and see if you relate. And I was like, okay, yeah, I can see what they're saying there. And I start reading some of these things, and I start reading this book, and I'm going, this is the worst written book I've ever read in my life. Like, who the hell wrote this thing? I'm reading it like a novel, right? And I'm going, this must be one of those, like, keepsakes they give you, like a history thing, you know, because they gave me a chip and said, I'll always be recovering and just don't drink and go to meetings. So I guess I don't have to pay attention to much of what's in here. So I didn't. And I went off, and I'm down there in South Florida, and I go to this bar behind this couch that I'm sitting on at my buddy's house. He stayed in this, you know, Boynton Beach. He had this nice house. And I pick this drink up, and the worst thing in the world happens. Nothing. I was expecting my head to spin around. I was expecting something horrible to have my eyes glaze over white. Nothing happened, right? And I'm 12 years, furthest I've ever been away from a drink, right? So it's not... I'm not sitting here with like a craving or something that I'm like harboring or trying to stay away from. Like, I just, you know, okay, let me just do that. And alcohol started working. I got 3 more years out. I was able to drink on the weekends, right? But meanwhile, I'm like, I'm going to study this so I can then report it back. If this goes bad, I'm going to come back and report to you guys what I found so I can be helpful. So I actually... went out on a sociological experiment to improve my sobriety kind of a thing, after about 3 years, now all of a sudden I'm smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. I've got this scorching pill habit now. I'm drinking every day, and I'm thinking, I think I should probably go back to AA, thinking that I could. And I tried, and I'd get 30 days, 60 days, 90 days drink, and I'm going, I think I'm in trouble here. I'm having the same experience, like trying to stay sober, going to meetings, hearing people talk about their divorce one more time. And I'm saying, guys, I need to hear something that's going to keep me out of a liquor store by the time I get home. because I passed three of them on my way home. And I haven't been able to manage that yet. And I get 30 days, 60 days, 90 days drink, and I'm losing my mind, thinking I'm one of them constitutionally incapable people that you all talk about in these things. And and I'm dying. I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, like dying of thirst 10 feet from a freshwater lake, right? And I'm going, man, like, I don't understand what's going on here. Like, I really need to, there's got to be something they're not telling me. There's got to be these meetings, right? And I'm going to this one meeting in near where I live. It was up in Raritan at the time. And I just moved back up to Florida because I kind of blew my life up and nobody was like wanted to pay me to travel around the world anymore because I guess me smelling like booze at these tour events was a problem. And they kind of frown upon that out there. And I go through this phase where I start going to these meetings and I'm saying, man, I'm hoping I hear something tonight that's going to keep me from drinking. And I'm still getting sicker in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go to this meeting one night in Raritan, and there's this young guy there who's pretty well put together. At the time, he was about my age. And he's looking around the room telling about these old-timers back when he was in his early 20s like I was. And they'd just tell him to get in the car. And they'd start talking about this blue book that they'd read to him, and they'd have him do some things that the book suggest, and all of a sudden his life started getting better. And I was just like, it was odd because I'd never heard anybody come and talk at a meeting and not talk about their life stuff, their work, their divorce, their lawnmower, things like that. This was a shock to me. I was like, what's this guy talking about? And he happened to turn and catch eyes with me, and he said, you have absolutely no idea how sick you are. And I was like... And he kind of went on about, my world stopped. He said that through me. I believed him. And I knew he was right. But I was like, whatever that guy's talking about, that's what I got. And of course, I didn't walk up to him and say, what did you mean by that? I drank vodka at this guy for 6 months. I'd wake up in the middle of the night going, what was he talking about? What does he mean by that? Right? Because I'm thinking my problem's alcohol, and I have no idea, one, how big the problem I have really is, and two, how big the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous has. Like, I'm thinking we just kind of come here and just watch each other not drink and go to meetings, because that's all I'd ever experienced. I'd watch people chair and make coffee, and we'd kind of drive and have that talk in the car kind of thing, and it was great fellowship, thinking that was going to treat what was wrong with me. Had never even heard about these other pieces that this book talks about. So I drink for some more time, and I get another 90 days, and I'm going to meetings, and people are giving me these prayer cards with the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, and I'm praying these things and meaning it. And I'm still drinking. And I remember walking, I was at this church behind at Rocky Hill, and it's an absolute downpour. And I'm just losing my mind, bawling in this car, going, oh my God, I'm either going to put a gun in my mouth or I'm going to keep drinking. And either way, this is not going to end well. Now, the thing that scared me wasn't the fact that I was going to keep drinking or dying. It was the fact that I thought I was going to keep drinking, feeling the way I was feeling for 40 more years. Because that I couldn't do, and I didn't have the courage to commit suicide. But it was on the table, right? And that had never been on the table sober. Never. And I'm walking around in this meeting, and I walk in, and I'm just, it's on me. And people see it, and they're just telling me to take it easy and, go to more meetings of all things. And I go in there, and this lady opens this little booklet up and reads this announcement for this thing called the Jersey Shore Roundup. I was like, this huge AA conference down in Long Branch, right? And I'm going, what the heck? It's like a year away. And I had started hearing people talk about listening to these speakers on YouTube, right? And I started listening to like Sandy Beach and Bob Darrell, and I really loved like Bob Darrell because his voice was just like the ultimate narrator for self-pity, which it was all over me. He just has that, and it was just, I got to get me off of me kind of stuff. And I was like, man, that's the ER voice that I carry around with me. Like, that was me. So... I'm still not drinking and trying to not drink and go to meetings and failing miserably. And I just remember this one day, I got a job that I hate. I'm a golf pro up in Western New Jersey, right? And I got a little guy. Now I'm married with a wife and a kid, and he's 18 months old. And I had this evening where I was absolutely, like, sick, like, toxic. And it was like alcohol poisoning. And I remember walking out to smoke a cigarette, and this little guy's kind of following behind me, and I close the door, and I'm outside. It's one of these crisp, clear January days in 2014, not a cloud in the sky kind of a thing. And I'm smoking the cigarette, and I hear this little guy banging on the glass, and I turn around, and I didn't see him. I caught my reflection in the French doors, and I saw that thing again. And on the spot, I was filled with mortal fear. Like, I had this bright light burning bush experience on my back porch. Now, any spiritual awakening that I had had before was kind of the educational variety that kind of time brought you and, you know, things like that. But this thing, this was different. Like, I was literally filled with mortal fear. And this predates my sobriety date by 3 months, okay? And on the spot, I'm relieved of a 20-year cigarette addiction. Like, I'd never had a cigarette since. Now, here's the problem with that. I start hallucinating. I start going through acute nicotine withdrawal. I can't sleep at night. Within 30 days, I'm fired from the job I hate. Now I'm going to 3 meetings a day with having the same experience that I had in Alcoholics Anonymous before, losing my mind, going through this horrible nicotine withdrawal. 90 days later to the day, the same thing happens with booze and drugs. And now I'm withdrawing from opiates, alcohol, and nicotine. No detox, no anything. I am literally vibrating out of my mind in AA rooms. And there's three seats open around me. Kyle remembers, he was there. And nobody would talk to me. Nobody would talk to me. There was these two guys, 42 years sober, like old man Bill, we call him. Who's the other guy? It was old man Bill. And I can't remember his name. He'll kill Andy. Jeez, my God, I can't believe I forgot Andy. But they knew that. They understood that helplessness. And I couldn't formulate sentence. People would ask me to read, and I'd just pass. And I'm literally out of my mind. And I got like a year before this thing happens, and I'm trying to read. I get this guy that's 42 years as a sponsor. We start reading this big book like a novel, and I start having the same experience, and I'm starting to get sicker and sicker, and I'm insane on top of this. And I have to white knuckle it for about close to a year. And I take this guy down to this thing called the Jersey Shore Roundup, right? And I start hearing these people for the first time start talking about step one and the phenomenon of craving. Like, what the hell is that? That sounds like something I'd be pretty useful to know, right? That you have an allergy to alcohol, like people with strawberries or shellfish and things like that. And as you start to ingest this stuff, I don't process that regular. I break out in a thing called a craving for more, where somebody would break out with hives, or their throat would swell up, and they'd have to go to the emergency room, get a shot of Benadryl, and you'd come home, you take the dude home, you go back to see him and check on him the next day, and he's sitting there eating a bowl of strawberries again. You'd be like, dude, I don't think your problem is strawberries. Like, there's something that's not right about your head that makes you, after what you just went through today, the fact that you would go home and eat more strawberries thinking how somehow, some way, this would be different, right? See, I don't think strawberries is your biggest problem, right? The problem is, for you, is you've got a mind that tells you that's not a problem, and you're going to trigger that allergy over and over and over again. And there's no human power that can stop you with that. And I'm sitting there looking at my sponsor at the time, Bill, and I'm going, you ever hear anybody say this before? You ever hear of anybody talk like this before? And he looks at me and he says the saddest thing ever. Now, this guy's 42 years sober, old school. He says, no, but they're professional speakers. I said, what the hell's that got to do with anything? And that's when I realized I needed a new sponsor, right? And I started to hear these guys talk about this, then they kind of get you to step two, and I'm going to kind of outline what I'm going to talk about over the next few weeks, which I kind of love this format because I can kind of be like the big book and tell you what I'm going to tell you, then I'm going to tell you, then I can tell you what I told you, that kind of thing. And that's kind of what I started to get a preview of. Like, all of a sudden, there's no human power that can relieve me of this thing. And I had a big problem with religion. You know, I had some abuse from, an aggressive father when I was a kid, and a lot of physical abuse and things like that, and everybody was very Catholic and doing this, and it's like, here, do as I say, not as I do. Here, take my advice, I'm not using it, kind of a thing. You know, and I have a problem with that when I'm 8 years old and I'm being pushed up the wall by my neck telling me I'm wrong and I have no idea what I did for that to happen. Right? So all of a sudden, you're going to cram that stuff that you're not doing down my throat. So when it came to this whole step two thing, I was like, Catholic, check, moving on, right? And, you know, the third step for me when I had first gone through this was basically say the prayer, do this inventory thing, and then just kind of fizzle off into meetings, and that was my treatment for this terminal illness, right? And I'm hearing something completely different for the first time in my life at this conference, and I'm hearing people talk about leave the gun on the table. Right? What we're going to do is any old idea that you have about this religion, just you can hold on to it, but just leave the gun on the table for now and be willing to have a new experience as a result of taking some steps, right? Because you kind of get to step two in a bad mood. You don't get there in a good mood. You get there with a gun to your head. You either accept spiritual help or go on to the bitter end. And alcoholics are the only people on the planet who are like, tell me more about that bitter end. Right? Because I don't like the solution. Right? I know I've got this problem that I can't solve, but I got this other solution I don't like. Our book calls that a dilemma. Two equally unacceptable alternatives. There is no door number three. Now, I tried that door number three for 12 years. Just don't drink, go to meetings, get the right type of job. Just don't drink, go to meetings, get the right type amount of money in the bank. Just don't drink, go to meetings, have the right girlfriend, right? Go to the right vacation spot, you know? I had this problem thinking that there was something out there that was going to fix in here. And I still have it today. But the thing is it's I this process turns that voice down. Right? See, when I came into this process, I thought, still for the longest time, that alcohol and drugs was my problem. And as we got through step two, I was just like, okay, I wasn't going to have that experience. So this little lady gets up there at the Jersey Shore Roundup named Katie Parker. And she starts outlining this process of all these requirements for step three. And I'm going, whoa. I've only ever heard that it's this prayer. And she riffed on this third step thing for 45 minutes and never mentioned the prayer. And I was like, where the hell did you come from? She's 5'0", 100-0. And it's like, you know, her husband, Charlie, describes her as she's like taking a drink out of a fire hose. You're always going to get a little bit more than you bargained for. And she gets up there and she goes through this thing. And it was like she parted the room and spoke directly at me. And I'm sitting there at this thing, and I'm like literally glued. I did not miss a conversation of what these speakers were talking. I sat in my chair the entire time. And I was exhausted, right? And I went through this great workshop with Larsine G. She's an Al-Anon speaker. And I started to see how my alcoholism affected others, those people close to me. Because I was just like, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Leave me alone kind of a thing. And I started to see this other perspective. And I started to see that maybe I have more of a problem than just alcohol and drugs. And I'm hearing a lot about selfishness and self-centeredness. I don't know what that's all about. And then Ralph W. from California gets up there and he starts going through this process and the fear inventory and the sex inventory. I was like, sex inventory? What the hell is that? That was one of my favorite tools to try to, you know, door number three, which we never talk about in AA, right? My selfish sexual, self-centered sexual misconduct. That I let's not talk about that while these cute new girls come in here and we go over there and here, let me show you what we do around here kind of a thing. And you know, I've watched a lot of people get sick behind that, you know, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I fortunately am married to a non-alcoholic, and I'm one of those people, and I've watched her drink, you know, like a cat watches you eat a tuna fish sandwich kind of a thing. I have watched her drink, and she doesn't have what I have. Like, and she can be a hard drinker. Like, I've seen her do it, and I've seen her, like, you know, you might have a little bit of a problem there. But I've seen her the next night. I've seen her go on a year and drink three times, but I've also seen her, you know, in a month just get tore up, you know, and I'm just like, how do you do that? Like, just the other day, I remember coming back, she'd mixed a drink for herself, and I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning, and the drink was still on the table with that much out of it. I was like, I can't relate to that. I don't fathom that. There's so much more to get out of alcohol than that. Just like there's so much more to get out of AA than what I was doing. You know, I hitch my wagon to meeting-based sobriety thinking that this, you know, meetings, fellowship, as awesome as it is a one-legged stool. And I have a three-part illness. You know, the Jersey Shore Roundup taught me that. And these speakers came and shared their experience with me. And I hear, you know, step 4 and 5 from Ralph, and then 6 and 7 was Bob Darrell, who blew my hair back. I was like, what are you talking about, character defects? And I started to realize this common theme, which I'm going to kind of try to relate to this week, is, you know, we drink because of selfishness and self-centeredness, right? That's at the root of our problem, right? And then it sets up the need for inventory, because I got to see how I'm blocked from this power, right? So I'm going to kind of outline how I went through that and came to this understanding, because this entire process is about my character defects, my step 3 deal, my 6 and 7. It's like, don't worry about 1 and 2 because we're going to be doing 6 and 7 later, right? And then I get to 3 and found out what the root of my problem was, selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the root of my troubles, not vodka, right? And then it starts to show up that I'm going to have to turn my will and my life over to this power, right? So it's a fair assumption to ask for a newcomer to ask, what does that mean? What does that look like? So Bill, in his infinite wisdom, starts to describe what that looks like, what an unsurrendered life looks like. And he starts to set the need for inventory, right? I got to look at these manifestations of self if I'm going to be free of them, because that's what's blocking me from this power. That's why I drink. Because of the pain of living a selfish, self-centered life. Because it's so against my values and my belief systems that I deal with that, because I got no tools, I deal with that with alcohol. And then I line out. I'm gonna try to bring in some of my forms that I give my sponsees and stuff of how we go through inventory. Because my first experience now, if you're new and you're going with this, I'm gonna do this for the exact way the book outlines. I'm gonna keep it super simple. I'm gonna explain a lot of this stuff in a fifth step with somebody new. But we got like a lot of people who've been here for a little bit, so if I can offer any other different perspective, I hope to do that. So I'll bring in some forms for you guys. You can kind of, you know, take it or leave it kind of stuff. And then, let's see, 8 and 9 was done by Larry Thomas, so I'll share some amends stories with that and how we live in 10, 11, and 12. But I remember going through this process, you know, and after I got through this, that day of the first run through the steps, I'm sitting out at the coffee maker, and this little pepper pot comes bouncing up, and it's Katie. And she just starts talking to me like she's known me for years, and she sees the look on my face, and she's like, it's a lot, isn't it? I'm like, yeah, this is intense. Like, I've never heard any of this before, and I thought I did AA. And she goes, stick around till my husband does 12. You'll get another earful. And I was just like, so we started talking, and, you know, and she gave me her number and her information, and I sit through the rest of this process, and I start hearing, like, the other stuff was kind of off my radar. Nobody had ever asked me to help them. Nobody wanted what I had, right? So there was no sponsorship or anything like that, which is an absolute integral part of this process. Right? So I drink because of my toxic selfishness and self-centeredness. I need God, this relationship, whatever this higher power is. I got to look at how these things manifest. I got to make these requirements that I got to stop playing God. I got to turn my will and my life. God's going to be the director. All that stuff. And I make a deal with this power. That this power is going to provide what I need if I stay close to Him and perform His work well. Like, that's it. There ain't nothing else. Those are the deal. That's the terms of the deal. So I completely missed that for years. So otherwise, what I missed was the root of my problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life until I die of something else. Other than that, didn't miss much. And I was like, whoa, man, that's heavy. That's why it's the keystone. That's why it's the step that holds all the other stuff. Because step 1 and 2 lead up to it. All the other steps point back to it. And affirm the terms of that deal. So I kind of have to walk through this process and see that truth in step 3 and write about it in 4 so a sponsor can sit down with me in step 5 and adjust my attitude or get me to see things from a completely different angle. And attitude being an old aeronautical term meaning angle of approach, my perspective, right? How I'm looking at things. Now, there's no better way than to see that than writing a resentment inventory. And as I look at what they did in or who they are in column one, what they did in column two. And not just that it affects those areas of self, how it affects those areas of self. Because that's where I get to see my old ideas and belief systems. And something that we do in our lineage is we talk about stage characters and all their belief systems and programming. And a lot of this process has gotten me to look at outside literature, like Anthony DeMello and Tolle and all these guys that kind of help you see things from a different perspective other than this one that I do along with, not instead of. And it's really helped me get to see things from a different angle and opened up other doors. Because, you know, even Bill calls this, we realize we only know a little. This is spiritual kindergarten, which blows my mind because I was, I'd gone to Catholic, the whole thing, CCD was an altar boy, and I was like, man, I never even touched anything like this. And I'd gone to church, right? And it just kind of blew my mind. So as I start going through this process and I see all these manifestations of self, and my sponsor gets me to see things from a different angle, you're damn right I find something objectionable in it. I start to see how these things show up in my life, and that I'm like the father. Nobody should, the father provides. The father takes care of their kids. That, has all these old ideas and beliefs. These are my scripts, my expectations that I walk around in life with. And if you violate them, you're in column one. I blow up, I go off, I blow a gasket, realizing I don't, after I do a fist up, I start to learn that I have absolutely no right to make any expectations of you whatsoever. It's not like you're sitting around, working on, let me find a way to screw Steve over today. I'm going out there and I start making these decisions based on self, which later place me in a position to be hurt. Remember that great statement of hope that we have. And, my sponsor, who I met in the process of going through 1 through 3, and I'll get into more of that detail of that, like that talk took me through the rest of this process once Katie lined me out on the inventory process. And then I find out I have some things after I do the hour and the fifth step. I go into this process of finding things objectionable and asking them to be removed, like finding out that, yeah, man, take these things. I can't do anything with them. And a lot of these things dropped, and I was just like, except porn. Maybe not porn. Maybe not that one, because I need something, right? I need something to get my head. And that was the first thing that went, which blew my mind. It was one of my favorite toys, because it was something that I could find peace and ease with, right? And these, what's weird is these are one of those things that you say in an AA meeting, and everybody's like, you just said that out loud. I'm like, yeah, because it no longer has that hold on me. It's not a source of shame for me anymore. It was a distraction that I used to get away from me. And it blocked me from all these other things in my life, And I had to learn that. I only learned that through inventory. So if you're new and you're scared to death of inventory, run to inventory. It's the greatest tool I've ever used. And the way I've then learned to use it later through this deeper process has opened things up. Like, I can get to the fourth column. Like, you piss me off in a sentence, and I'm like, column one, column two. And I'll run through this process, and then I start to see it in column three. And then when I get to column four and I realize what my mistakes were, all of a sudden, that column four turns column one and two into a lie, and I'm free. Right? And as I go through that process, then I start to see that this, I now have to go out and make amends for things because of what my manifestations of self drove me to do that I was asleep to. So this whole thing is about self. And I was like, you always made your life about you, but now it really is. But not in the way I would have hoped, right? But that right now seems horrible to say, but it's actually one of the biggest things of hope in our program, because I can change me through this process with the help of a sponsor and my higher power. And that'll take me through and get me to have completely new experiences that, whereas before I would look at him, he's like, I'm not getting what I want. And nobody else has to change. How I look at things change. How I think. It's my biggest problem is the story my mind tells me about what happened. Because I believe it. I had to learn through prayer and meditation that I'm not my thinking mind. My mind is like a Windows program throwing off programs, and I'm like printing out everything and acting on its behalf as if it's the dead-on truth that I've believed my whole life. And it's one of those things that I'm now realizing I'm the one watching my thinking mind. My thinking mind's supposed to be a tool where I've been a slave to it my whole life. thinking that, you know, whatever it thinks is right, it must be me, it's in my voice. You know, forgetting the fact that the same voice that told me to put alcohol down was the same voice that told me to pick alcohol back up. And I started to realize, man, my mind's trying to kill me. You know, I got to hold everything it says suspect. You know, I got to have a group of guys that, you know, we during the pandemic, we put together a Zoom group, which was, you know, how we do our circle and triangle check-in. How many meetings did you get to this week? How many, where are you at with your step work and your discipline, your evening reviews, your on-awakenings? Who are you helping? Right? It helps keep us accountable. And, you know, most of us are still here. You know, a couple of people, this pandemic, I did not pandemic well. I don't know about you guys. I had some experiences that I'll share with you later, but man, it was, I had a hard time. I'm an outdoor cat, and now all of a sudden I'm at home homeschooling an 8-year-old. Anybody have to write inventory on an 8-year-old for acting like an 8-year-old? This guy, right? And it was horrifying, right? And, you know, thank God for, you know, Step 12 and the guys that I work with and stuff like that, because it got me to turn out of me. Right? It got me, I was going to all these workshops on Zoom and this, that, and the other thing. It was fantastic until we got back in person. And that's where this thing kind of took off. So when I first started, you know, going into, you know, the doctor's opinion and step one, and Charlie, he had sent me one of his talks. And if anybody, anything that I reference in here, I can send you guys. So if you guys have want any of these talks sent to you or any forms or sheets that I sent, I'll bring some in. But if you guys want them, feel free to email me. I'm happy to send them to you and do with what you will. But this whole thing about the doctor's opinion and the, you know, the body, the phenomenon of craving. You know, when I'm working with somebody, and what was done with me was we used to turn statements into questions, right? And answer them based on our own experience, you know, the, kind of like that whole Denver Big Book thing back from the young people's group back in the day. And, you know, I'll go through, I'm working with a new guy here, and a lot of these guys, I'll be on Zoom calls in treatment, you know, and they've got a guy there that's, you know, kind of helping them educate about the book, what the problem is and things like that. And then they'll talk with somebody like me in their area. And I'll start qualifying them immediately. I'll start walking them through this process. And, you know, we've got, you know, starting with the, you know, the doctor's opinion and a couple of the sentences there, in this statement, he confirms that, and I put myself in this, Steve, who has suffered alcoholic torture, drunk or sober, must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Like, this is the first time I had to start to concede to the fact that, you know, there might not be both oars in the water up there, right? I might have a problem with my thinking, my mind. I remember the first time I found out what alcoholism was in the doctor's opinion. And it was like, I felt like I was like Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense when he found out he was the dead guy. I was like, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. Like, I had said it, heard it, never landed anywhere, right? So, it did not satisfy us to be told that Steve could not control his drinking just because Steve was maladjusted to life, that Steve was in full flight from reality, or was an outright mental defective. I thought that was strong language, right? It's absolutely true. But we are sure that Steve's body is sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory, which is no longer a theory, it's actually been proven because of the pancreas and the chemicals and all, I can't remember what it was, but Chris Raymer sent me something on it, and I was just like, whoa, that's crazy. This guy, Dr. Silkworth, observed so many of us that he was able to surmise on observations that, like, we have an allergy, like strawberries or things like that, to alcohol, which I thought was crazy. So every year I go down to this Jersey Shore Roundup. We go down the highway, was it 35 or something like that, and behind this Walgreens is where Dr. Silkworth is buried. And we stop in there, and we'll, you know, some guys will go in and we'll read the doctor's opinion, which is pretty heavy. Like, we went up in there, and somebody brought a bunch of sheets of the doctor's opinion printed out, and there was like six of us standing around Dr. Silkworth's grave reading the doctor's opinion. Had a totally different experience. I was like, wow, this is nuts. And it's just this little unassuming tombstone with a bunch of AA coins on top. It's really wild. All right, so the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. This guy is the absolute best doctor on alcoholism at the time, right? And he's saying, we got nothing else for you other than this, right? And it's, which is pretty wild. Now, when we get over here to XXVIII, it says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So I was taught to think about it like this. It's like, imagine you got a bunch of second graders, and there's all different types of second graders. You got tall ones, thin ones, fat ones, skinny ones, black ones, white ones. The one thing that they all have in common is that they're all in the second grade. Nothing else matters. That's what makes it our common problem. If you don't got it, you don't got it. Now, I did this for a guy who was bipolar, which I didn't know at the time, and we went through this part, and I watched his face fall. And he goes, Steve, I don't drink. And he's been going to AA meetings. And I'm going, are you okay? And he saw that he was using those things to kind of balance himself. And I was like, wow, man. So I just kind of was like, look, go talk to your doctor. Find out what you need to get. But I haven't seen him since. But it was crazy watching that, because that never happened to me before. I'm always like, everybody passes with flying colors. I go, congrats, you just qualified for a terminal illness. Now it says why we drink. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. A little understated, but yes. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Like I couldn't when suddenly the thought crossed my mind in Florida. 12 years, right? Like, this, I'm okay now. Certainly this amount of time has qualified me to drink as others. Look at how successful I've gotten. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that one hit me like a ton of bricks. I had no idea that after the third or fourth drink where I finally exhaled, that's what those moments of peace I was searching for. That stopped working. That stopped happening after a period of time, right? And then I was chasing it, thinking I could recreate that again. And then I'd have to try other things to try to balance that out. And I never could. I never could get it. So, as I'm being brought through this stuff, and I'm answering this stuff on my own experience. Like, all of a sudden, I'm getting this book that was written, published in 39 on me, right? And whereas I had read this thing before, and I was like, man, I've never heard any of this stuff before. Never has it ever landed on me like this. So now this thing that was written back in the 30s now applies to me in 2014. And I'm like, how the hell did they write a book about me back then? And all it was, and the way this thing was written simply assures me that I need to ask another alcoholic for help and explain me how to decode this thing. Because, I don't know about you when you got here, but my wheels weren't all together there. And I needed help and have this stopped and broken down and say, look, we're not going to, we're going to go and hit these high points here and find out, do you have this? Right? Because if this problem doesn't apply to you or you don't think you have it, you're not going to do what steps 2 through 12 ask you to do. You have to be brought to a hopeless state of a terminal case of alcoholism in step 1. Because this whole thing is going to put teeth behind step 2, whereas you walk to it with that gun to your head, and then they're going to kind of do a little bait and switch on us in step 3 and tell us what a real problem is. But what I love about this is they start to talk about the spiritual malady a little bit here. And they never quite tell us exactly what it is, right? They never quite tell us what the spiritual experience is too, because if you have an experience that differs from that, identificate out the door. But what they do tell us is precisely how to have a spiritual experience with these steps. And they give you mechanics and examples and things like that. But I think it was just brilliantly written in the fact that, you're going to have your own spiritual awakening or experience. You're going to have your own idea of the spiritual malady because it's going to manifest differently. And I just think that's the one thing that kind of closes the door on, the alcoholic traps of me trying to find a way like, oh, I don't have to do that. Ooh, that's not me. Like all of a sudden, all the gates close in on me and I'm like, whoa. Now, what did you have to say about step 2? right? All of a sudden, I get a little bit more open-minded in this process. Because I remember telling Charlie when I was going through this, I was like, yeah, I skipped We Agnostics. He's like, maybe we ought to go back and give that a read, right? And so that's what I did. So, he finished this process here where he says, you know, ease and comfort. He says, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. That spells doom, right? That is a bad diagnosis from a doctor when he says you're doomed, right? And it's just like, tell me there's another way. Tell me there's a way out of this. Tell me. Now imagine, now think about the, you know, you look at the forewords and the prefaces, and they got like a 50 to 75% success rate if you go through this process the way it's written. And imagine they had, like, say, a pancreatic cancer cure out in Seattle that had a 50 to 75% cure rate. What wouldn't you do to get to Seattle? I would sell my house. I would sell your house to get to Seattle and have this experience. But this is the only... But think about the mind we have. This is where the insanity lies. We sit there and we see the hopelessness of step one. And then we're like... I don't really think I want to have to pay the money. I don't want to sit in front of that. But we start to pick and choose what we want to do with the treatment. Right? Only an alcoholic mind does that. Right? You think people who are on dialysis want to go and get their kidneys hooked up to like a car battery so they don't die? You'd do it if that was your only option. The 12 steps I have found with working with a bunch of people is the only thing an alcoholic wants to do in moderation. They want to pick and choose what they want to do. And that's what kills us. I am tired of going to funerals of people who wouldn't finish their amends, who wouldn't do an evening review. Right? I mean, think about it. I remember being at a detox with one of the guys I work with, and he's sitting there dying. And he's just, you know, and I'm feeding him vodka before he gets put in there because he'd go into, you know, DTs and stuff. And I just remember, he just kept looking at me. He was so out of it. He's just like, am I okay? Am I safe? He didn't know. And I remember, you know, when he came back and he had a little couple of lucid moments, I go, so evening review was too much to ask? And he's like, man, I know. That's the thing that we're dealing with. These manifestations of self that we act on their behalf take us away from this solution. So that's what I'm going to kind of try to cover and really kind of encompass what these 12 steps, kind of like a journey away from self and to self, in a sense, because we've got more than one. We got people up there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open it up for you guys, and hopefully we'll get hitting the ground running next week. So thanks for having me.